You're on the Philosopher's Zone. Good to have you along. Today, the mystery of memory.
Certainly, I have memories of my early career turn out to be completely false and fabricated. My parents have now told me I have a famous one when we went to Florida and a dolphin took my hat, which apparently never happened. But I retold that story as if it was a, you know, verified fact to all my friends and for most of my life. In fact, a lot of the memories that you think are the most cherished ones never really happened.
Daniel Hutto has a problem with his memory. Actually, he's got a problem with everyone's. The everyday belief about memory is that it's an archive somewhere in your brain. But it sets up a view which can be contested. And that's what this philosopher of psychology is doing with some gusto. He has another view of how memory might actually work. And it doesn't rely on the idea of the storehouse.
And so I come to the fields and vast palaces of memory, where are stored the innumerable images of material things brought to it by the senses. When I turn to memory, I ask it to bring forth what I want.
Dan Hutto, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. The familiar view of memory, what is it that we understand of memory? I note that you quote St. Augustine.
Augustine, of course, gives you the storehouse model in which we would place them like items in a drawer or in sort of an archive. And of course, that is a sort of picture that makes it sound as if memories are something that we keep within us and that we can retrieve and search for as necessary. So when we think back to a past event, we recover, say, if you really took this very, very seriously, you might think of it as a kind of inner recording that you replay of the past. And that invokes a kind of picture both about what memories are, where they're located, how we get at them, and also essentially what they are, which is a kind of representation, hopefully a faithful one, of what went on in our previous lives. So some event there. But of course, one thing about this is the very idea when you ask the question, like as if there was one characteristic or feature to memory, as if it was a singular thing, so that they're just memories and they're all of a piece. If we start with this standard picture, it makes it sound like all memories are like this. They're all sort of items that in some way could be stored. Modern day way of bringing that up to date might be to think of a computer metaphor. So we're very attracted to the idea that computers can store information. And so you might think there are all sorts of logical problems actually with the Augustine picture. So for example, that kind of picture going as far back as Plato and others, we might think that we have an aviary full of memories and you have to remember the appropriate item. But of course, that would be like calling forth the birds in the aviary back to your current purposes. But then you have to remember which bird to call. And if you store something in a drawer, as you well know, you also have to remember where you stored the item. We're moving house at the moment, so this is very, very pertinent. So you have to use your memory in order to locate the items themselves or something like this. So it suggests a kind of dangerous regress on some of the standard pictures.
Using memory to find memory.
To find the memory that you've stored or some system that does this. So those are actually challenges, theoretical, if you take that picture very seriously.
But that picture is taken very seriously. I mean, the science does track this to some degree. I've just read an article about protein synthesis and how various layers are laid down in the brain.
Well, it does or it doesn't. There's more than one science here. Usually in these cases, we have a story about what's happening at the level of the genetics or the neuroscience. I think there's also the psychology evidence, and you have to add all that up to question whether we have the right picture. So sometimes the science looks like it's endorsing one of these stories or pictures, but it may be more that the pictures are driving us to read the science in a particular way. There's usually more than one way to skin a cat, and there's usually more than one way to think about what those activities in neuroscience or those implementation methods are doing. So we could look at this and think perhaps, as you just said, the protein synthesis isn't doing quite the job the standard picture likes if we had a different picture of what memory was up to.
Mm-hmm. And this is where philosophy comes in, the bigger conceptual view. So what are the pictures then? If you feel that, if one feels that that storehouse, that archive, that view that's lasted for so long doesn't quite tell the full story, where do you start? What question do you ask then? Or what set of questions do you ask then?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting findings, apart from the neuroscientific work, would be, and this is a 30-year program in in psychology, looking at things like memory errors and distortions. So if we look at that work, it makes it hard to think that the biological brain is really set up to do something like just faithfully recover something that was stored in our memory, at least for lots of kinds of memory. Like I said, there are different varieties of memory. So we might want to differentiate between procedural memories. Those are like skills and habits, like
playing a guitar, riding a bike.
Playing guitar, riding a bike, finding my way. So it's interesting. It's a kind of mixed case. I've taken the train to this building before, but I couldn't actually just recall just from that alone how to get here. Once I'd got on the right path, it was easy to just follow it. And so it was just, I didn't have to think about it any longer.
So what is that? Are you, that's a procedural memory, you're saying?
Well, it's mixed. This is a mixed case. So here I had to both think, quite a lot of different kinds of memory came into play. So one, there was a bit of what I would call purely episodic remembering. I could recall at certain points, landmarks and how I'd stood in relation to them last time I came. I had to use some semantic memory to actually remember to find the actual map I downloaded from the internet so I could see, and I had to remember how to use that. So that's a bit of procedural, remembering how to use these things. But then I had to use them with specific name places on the board to figure out where I was going, right? I might have used a bit of autobiographical memory because I think you prompted me to say in the email that I had been here before. So I had to remember, yes, that was right. I came here once.
Were you going to your storehouse to find that autobiographical
But no,
detail?
I don't. So I think not, or at least not in the straight, clean version of the story. So what I think a lot of memory researchers have now turned to, so we come back to the storehouse example. I think they've turned to the idea that rather than thinking of you have a storehouse, you have at least a constructive element to what's going on. So the mind is more anticipatory in general. So there's a new movement in thinking about how perception and imagination work in this way. And so the thought would be when we're remembering, really what we're doing is, in a sense, reimagining a scenario. And in doing that, this would explain, I think, some of the other findings that we come across. So reimagining the past rather than just recovering a memory that has already been taken, snapshot, stored, and located somewhere. What we're doing is trying to think, what would it be like to be in this scenario? What is it like when I was here last? And of course, there's some, you might think, well, there's some element of recovery. There's reactivation is what I think is what's happening here. So nice positions on the imagination, think of it as a kind of recreative imagination, where what you do is you relive or reactivate certain patterns that maybe be phenomenologically salient. So things are what it's like to experience a certain thing is taken to be somewhat similar precisely because the same neural patterns are reactivated, but not in their entirety and just enough in order to re-enliven an episode. So here it's not like you have stored a recording as such, but it's a dispositional property that can get reactivated under the right prompts and conditions.
Dispositional. So how you felt about something or how you interpreted something or how it seemed to you at the time has been reactivated in some way. And this is different from the file.
Yes, the file. Well, I'd say that I saw this only in a footnote, but looking at the storage metaphor, at least one recent author rightly raised the worries. Is what we mean by storage isn't that we're really storing an item the way I would store a book of mine in my library, then that's what that metaphor invites, is if there was a content or an item that we've shelved and that we can then recover in its full glory, right? If it hasn't decayed or and somehow corrupted. What a dispositional property suggests is that we're prompted and we have a response. And so if you think of that as a re-prompting of our natural responding in a certain environment, but again, not recovery, because if we're reconstructing and reimagining what it would be plausible, we can get a lot of the details quite wrong, and we might even add details to the act of remembering. What the result of that might well be is, and indeed there's a lot of evidence that we do that. So phenomena in psychology known as, for example, the boundary effect is well known. So here it's that we tend to be additive to our memories. If you remember a scene, you might plausibly fill it out in a fuller sense than it was actually witnessed, but you will swear blind that the fuller version is how things really were. So they've done this a number of times in experiments, as opposed to a kind of a smaller scale version that cuts away from the boundaries what you actually saw. So you might think, here's a good case where that's treated as a memory distortion or error if you think that the purpose is faithful reproduction of the exact thing you've seen. However, you don't think of it as an error if you think, well, actually, that's what memory is really designed to do.
That's a radical point, isn't it? Because what you're doing now, I mean, in a sense, everything from our own personal memories that we cherish right through to giving testimony in court is challenged by that particular view that error is, in fact, the default position.
Well, or it's not error. It's rather that I like to think of it as, strike this analogy, it's like trying to think that it's not that we're never concerned about the truth about the past, but that our biological brains aren't about telling the truth at all. They're about reimagining plausible scenarios given what we've encountered. And so you're not recovering a previous content, a content-based version of memory. What you're doing is reconstructing a plausible possibility. Now, as you rightly said, of course, this work in psychology has really had a big effect on eyewitness testimony and other areas where people are concerned that, yeah, we're not reliable recorders of what happened. If this is right, we should be careful, because if it is right, we need to really rethink some of the tendencies of our assumptions. If we just assume such things, perhaps our biological brains were never meant to do this. So like I say, the analogy I might have in mind is like taking a car that's really built, or a bike that's built for the roads, and taking it up on a mountain pass. You know, you might force it to do certain things, but you also might damage it badly, or you might expect that it won't perform perfectly well because it's not designed to do that sort of thing. Mm. So the idea here is, yes, it is a radical shift about what the basic nature of memory is. It's not all the way through and through about representing contentfully how things are with the past, although that's something that we often ask of memory. So we want to know, what's the truth of the past? But perhaps that's a more collective enterprise than something our individual biological brains is something equipped to do.
A radical shift indeed. And perhaps it's got a lot more to do with what's on the outside as much as what's on the inside. Memory is a collective, not an individual enterprise. Daniel Hutto, philosopher with an eye on psychology, today on what makes memory tick, here on The Philosopher's Zone.
If what I was describing was even, you know, close to being on the right path about how we should understand biologically basic memories, then it raises the question, what goes on when we, as we normally do on a daily basis, ask about the past? We want to know, what was the truth? Did this really happen? And we take ourselves to be reasonably reliable. Although, I have to say, we probably don't test that in practice. When psychologists do test our ability to be reliable rememberers, they typically find that we're easily manipulated and that we're not very trustworthy. So somebody might say, well, I'm a very, you know, the listener today might think, well, I'm really good with my memory. My question would be, how do you know? When was the last time you really put that to the test? And if you only put it to the test in terms of your close circle of friends, it may turn out that of course, there, if you talk to my wife, we'll disagree an awful lot on who remembers what right. But we might be forgiving of those things because we're not really pressing them very hard. Take that to a court of law and it's a different kettle of fish. And when you need to find out the truth, you're right. I think the idea that it becomes a collective enterprise where we assess evidence in the way that we would in any other area where we're trying to get at the truth of a complex situation. Secondly, I think there's also this. We have to be educated into the practice of telling the truth and also thinking about our pasts in that kind of way. So it's not something that comes, if I'm right, natural to the biological brain. It's something that we are enculturated into. That means that there's a rather steep learning curve and sophisticated practices you have to master.
Just run that past me again, because that's very important what you've just said there, that it's not part of the biological brain necessarily. It's something we're sociologically or culturally enculturated into. What does that mean exactly? Are we saying that something doesn't exist prior in the brain that is about truth of the environment?
That's right. I mean, that's the extreme position. So the thought here is that we can ask questions. We get into a position to ask questions that make claims about the past that can be true or false. Of course we do. But that's not something our brains do. So this is an interesting thesis, and in fact, the new work that I'm pursuing really wants to separate these two aspects of mind. That's not to say, although some people, I think, misconstrue it, that we have two minds. We have a singular basis for our mind, which I think is interactive, but not contentful. But what that means to say is that basically we have capacities for engaging and interacting with the world. That's our primary biologically basic way of getting about, and our brains play an important part in all that, of course. But they don't make claims about the world. So some people in some traditions do think that the mind is essentially through and through representational. So brains do think and represent the world. But I think that's a challengeable hypothesis, and I think it's not the most fruitful way to think about our biologically basic equipment. What I think gets grafted onto that is a set of skills and practices so that we get into a position to make normative claims about how things stand with the world. And children take a long time, just like it takes a long time to learn how to read, take a long time to be able to sufficiently claim things and know what it would be to evaluate the claims of others. And there's a nice body of evidence in developmental psychology, rides under the heading of social interactionist theory of autobiographical memory, that says, look, they can chart these steps at the end of this, you know, third, fourth year of life, where children really are enculturated into thinking about their pasts, where they're part of it, and they can make claims such that they're part of that personal past, and they might make claims about what happened to them, which prior to that point, as the well-known phenomena of childhood amnesia shows, they're not able to really to even engage with this. So one of the nice findings is not just how susceptible we are to error, but that there's a lot of data that suggests that children, we as adults, can't really remember, typically at least, what happened to us in our early years.
I find that an incredible puzzle and quite a frustrating one, because you feel that you can have a memory when you were maybe 3 or 2 or 4. You don't really know. You've got this fragment. There is a fragment of content there, but you can't quite fish it out.
I think that's very true. Certainly, I have memories of my early career turn out to be completely false and fabricated. My parents have now told me I have a famous one when we went to Florida and a dolphin took my hat, which apparently never happened. But I retold that story as if it was a, you know, verified fact to all my friends and for most of my life. So we can be easily duped. That was my earlier point. We might be very sure about memories that we think are really our own, and yet it turns out those things never happen. I think that's quite alarming. I mean, if we just roll our eyes inward and think that we somehow know that we're reliable, have a reliable testimony about what happened in our own pasts, could easily turn out, and you may discover this, that in fact a lot of the memories that you think are the most cherished ones aren't, never really happened. And that's one issue. I think we have to be aware that it takes an awful lot of training to be able to think about that. So what the evidence suggests is that children start out by appropriating other people's memories and really assigning them as if those memories were their own. So they show that they're learning, they're mastering that narrative. Now, you mentioned the idea of a fragment, and I think that's right, but the fragment might not be a content. You said it was a fragment of content. I think that's a fragment that's potentially contentful once you weave it into a narrative.
What if I think I can see myself or have a phenomenal perspective?
That's fine. Mm. I think we want to distinguish, this gets into some rather subtle positions in philosophical space, but I suppose a way of carving up the take on memory that I've been propounding of late is that with the procedural memories we're talking about, we may not have any phenomenal aspect to them at all, right? So I can remember how to ride a bike, but I may not experience that in any particular way when I do so.
Does this explain those memory experts who seem to be able to memorize the telephone book and tell it to you? This is this extraordinary kind of...
Of course. Yeah. So I don't have a ready-made answers to how they do their tricks. I do know that for ordinary folk, there are techniques that we can use where we latch on to. So what you would do is embed your technique on top of another. One thing that memory experts do is we're very good at remembering stories. So one thing that people, even in ordinary nature, can do is you can remember complex semantic facts by remembering a story and then writing a story where you get a prompt on the first letter of each bit of your story, and you can remember the story sequence, and then that enables you to remember something like as complicated as the periodic table. I don't say that all the people who do kind of the savant style remembering are using a similar technique, but there may be something equivalent there. But I think what's really interesting is the thought that you could have you know, the great swathe of memory on the planet is going to be procedural. Sea slugs do that, and birds and bees and all sorts of critters, and us too. And we don't perhaps notice it, right? So I remember how to speak right now, and I don't think about it phenomenologically. There's no, not saying I'm unconscious, but I'm not saying that there's a particular phenomenology with everything that we recall how to do in terms of remembering how. What I think is also interesting is, this is something I've been pursuing, you could have purely episodic, phenomenal forms of episodic memory of an event or how it was like. A famous Proust example of remembering the smell of the Madeleines. So you can have something like that, I think, without, as a fragment that might weave itself into a story, but without that already being contentful. It's not making a claim in and of itself. So you can imagine a creature enjoying those experiences, but not having the capacity to think about the world in terms of truth or falsity or how things stood in that respect. So I think that we can talk there about recovering a purely episodic, phenomenally charged way of imagining things that's a form of memory that comes before and below our ability to think about that as part of our autobiography or to make claims about the past that could be true or false. So that's the idea. And if those things do come apart, that's an important finding that, as you say, might make us rethink a lot of our kind of standard practices, both with respect to, say, the law or education or any number of areas. Memory, of course, gets everywhere.
It sure does. It's very much new thinking. Tell me about what you're working on now. Memory has been a very important part of this, clearly for what it's potentially saying about memory, which is actually quite, I think, a very radical thing and could, you know, overturn a lot of, you know, important ways in which we deal with each other.
I say that the bigger, if we helicopter up, it's a bigger picture, is, as you just said, there's whole swathes of new things we have to make this story work in its full form and to make it credible. We have to deal both with the empirical work. I think that's unavoidable. Some philosophers have been less keen to engage with the empirical sciences. I think we have to respect them, but without kowtowing. That's to say, I don't think the sciences have answers to these difficult philosophical questions, and the difficult philosophical questions can only get properly answered by respecting what the scientists tell us about these phenomena. But I do think we need to start to look at the nature of explanation. We need to look at the nature of dynamic systems, whether or not we want to think of how do we make sense of this idea of, if we took it that far, extensive minds that have reach. The new book that we're bringing out with MIT, I'm co-authoring again with Eric Meehan, is called Evolving in Activism, Basic Minds Meet Content. So this is the bigger story about how, if we start with minds that don't have that feature, how is it that minds get to have it? How do they interface? How do we understand a range of phenomena better by having that, what we call a multi-story story about how minds are? So they're fundamentally interactive, but some minds involve content. So some minds are capable of thinking about the world in ways that they can be correct or incorrect in some sense about how the world is, but that's an achievement. So the idea here is that you would say that all minds, I think, are, they're interactive and dynamic, not that they're representational.
It seems to me, without actually dumbing it down to one sentence, that the capacity for people to tell stories to one another is seriously demarcating aspect of being human.
Yeah, I was and have been asked more than once whether this is an attempt to establish a kind of human distinctiveness story. No, not really. The claim is really that there has to be certain practices in place in order for these things to happen, and I don't know where we demarcate where those are. First of all, as far as human distinctiveness goes, there's huge parts of the galaxy we haven't investigated, so I have no idea what other kind of creatures might be telling stories. But you're right. One issue is, for some forms of our thinking, like the autobiographical memory, I think that does essentially involve telling stories about our past and mastering those skills. So you really can't have those kinds of memories, if this is right, without those abilities. How widespread those abilities are, which creatures have them, those are fun and open questions. I don't want to pronounce that only humans, I'm not an only humans sort of guy, but it may turn out, as a matter of fact, that it's just humans who have those capacities in their full-blown form.
Well beyond the familiar picture, Daniel Hutto with a theory of memory. He's Professor of Philosophical Psychology at the University of Wollongong. And while I remember, thanks today to Diane Dean and Joe Wallace. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you next time in the Philosopher's Zone. And before I go, a quick word about the new series of Short and Curly. Take a bunch of curious kids, a couple of classical ethical dilemmas, throw in a master ethicist, and you get a brain-bending podcast series. If you haven't heard it yet, the next series has just gone up. Would you tell a lie? Should you eat your pet? Does science tell the full story? And should we move to Mars? Just some of the puzzles in the next series. Links on our site, or look up Short and Curly. It's one time where you won't tell your children to shut off their devices.